Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this special edition of the 14th Fire American Soccer Show. Yesterday evening in England, in London, England, the United States, the young kids fall to the Three Lions by a final of 3-0. Joining me, of course, from World Soccer Talk, Kartik Krishnayar, as we recap this match of the these last two international friendlies in the month of November, and the final matches of the 2018 calendar. We're not going to mince words here, folks. We're just going to go ahead and delve right into it. Kartik Krishnayar, your thoughts, please, and there will be no interruptions from me. Go right ahead. Your thoughts.
Well, I'm not even sure that I have that many thoughts. We'll delve into it, clearly, but this was a shambolic performance, an embarrassing performance, a performance that was epically bad by any standard. I tend to not look at friendlies as decisive in our decision-making or our thought process about this national team. Don't get too high or get too low after friendlies. That's been my viewpoint through the years. However, this was such a bad performance. This was up there with some of the really bad performances I remember. I remember this lifeless performance against Argentina in the Copa America in 2015. I remember the performance in San Jose in 2009 at Saprissa, where they opened us up in the first few minutes, Costa Rica did, and we were on the back foot that entire night. I think back at the rather embarrassing performance at RFK in 1997 against Jamaica. That was qualifier. And a match we drew, but this really, they should have beat us that night. And Jeff Andrews almost gifted them the game. There are very few performances for the U.S. I mean, there have been some friendlies that have been really bad, obviously. Brazil game 2010, Spain game in 2011. But I don't remember a match where I felt like, okay, so what I felt like has happened in some of these other matches is that we've been outclassed and we've been overmatched. And that overmatching and outclassing comes in time. What I saw was in the first minute of this match, the U.S. defending deep, the shape being frayed. I'm talking about within 30 seconds. And essentially, guys not knowing where their teammates were, not reading the game, and you're facing an England team that is heavily rotated, right? We're playing a young England team, not the team that was the semifinals in the World Cup. There was obviously a Lingard and Dele Alli who started that semifinal against Croatia, which they lost, and the goalkeeper Pickford. But other than that, I think it was a completely different squad, starting 11. Callum Wilson, mm-hmm. with Trump getting their first caps. But my point is, I think our team underestimated the hunger of young English players to impress, because there's a lot of competition for spots on the English national team right now. You don't play Kane, you don't play Sterling, but attacking players are thinking, okay, this is my chance. And we just did not react well. The speed of decision-making was really poor, Daniel. The shape was bad. The lack of creativity, lack of continuity in passing going forward, you name it, we got it wrong.
And I agree with you. They looked terrible. And, you know, the one thing that really bothered me, just like what you just said, was that there's a difference here between what we saw from England and what we saw from the United States. The United States, in my opinion, as at this point in time, Kartik, it's still a feeling out process, if you want to call it that. If you want to call it that, fine. If not, then that's fine. You can use whatever terminology you want. But to me, it was still more of a feeling out process for the United States than what it was for England, because England, you know, they just went through a World Cup. This is the furthest they've been in a World Cup since maybe 1966 when they won it on home soil. They
Correct.
Went as far as they
yeah.
did. It was a shock. Thank you very much. Well, I didn't see that. I didn't see that one, but that's okay. But, you know, when you're seeing players from England looking to impress Southgate, and they showed themselves to be very impressive, you know, these players who are doing a good job under Dave Sarakin, they all know that, you know, what do I have to impress him for? You know, why do I have to impress him for? You know, this is it. He's done. That when the end of November comes, when this second and final November friendly comes in a couple of days against Italy at Belgium, it'll be on a neutral country, neutral site. What do I have to impress Sarakin for? I don't have to impress him. I don't have to go out there and impress him anything. It's I'm waiting for, and we all believe it will be Greg Berhalter, the worst kept secret in the history of U.S. soccer head coaches, because apparently there was no coaching search. There was no searching for to see who is
okay,
going
so
to
I
be.
Can, I can confirm a couple of things here, Daniel. Sorry to cut you off, but real quickly.
Sure.
I can confirm Jesse Marsh was not interviewed. I am told Peter by Taylor Twellman, Peter Vermees was not interviewed, and I have been told by someone else that Juan Carlos Osorio was not interviewed either, even though he was interested in the job. So take that for what it's worth. I don't think there was a formal process based on those three nuggets. But, you know, maybe there was. Go ahead.
Yeah, we never know. But as I'm saying already, you know,
but again,
they don't have to impress
Juan Carlos Osorio. If you're not going to interview Juan Carlos Osorio or Jesse Marsh, I'm not quite sure who you're going to interview for this job. I mean, so I have to believe there was no process because those would be the first two names on most people's list. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. You know, no, absolutely. I mean, those are the names I would have given right off the bat. And I don't think they want to interview anybody. I think they just want somebody that just, you know, just here's the job for you, take it and run with it. That's all it is. But as I'm saying already, and I will also say this, Cardick, while you are correct that they are run out of the park, and give credit to the English players, and I mean, my God, Jesse Lingard, that was a hell of a strike in the 25th minute.
Yeah.
That's a goal you're never going to stop. I don't care where you're positioned. I don't care where you're positioned on the pitch or inside your area. I mean, Matt Miazga, if you want to claim he's in no man's land, you can claim that as much as you want. Should he have gone up to Lingard and stopped him? Probably should have. Or maybe if he would have walked up to him or tried to defend him, he probably would have taken the ball and attacked around him. You don't know in that area. I'll just give that as an excellent strike by Lingard, which it was. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you probably got to say Miazga was in no man's land there. But the second goal that was converted by Trent Alexander-Arnold, that was shameful. That was shambolic defending. And it's not just it was shambolic defending, not even paying attention to where he was, and then an easy opportunity for him to put that ball on frame and beating Brad Guzan, which once again, you know, he's a very good club keeper with Atlanta, even though he always puts himself in a bad position tactically inside his area. We'll see what happens against the Red Bulls in these playoffs. But once again, Brad Guzan, I know Zach Steffen took himself out because of a hamstring issue, which is fine, but Brad Guzan, in my book, is no longer viable for the U.S. men's national team at all anymore. But still, though, Cardick, it comes to a point where the U.S. men's national team, these young players, you know, if it's not for Tyler Adams coming into the second half as a substitute, and I'll say this, and I'm not trying to toot the Red Bull's horn or anything like that, but let's be honest with ourselves here. Will Trapp does not fit into the international scheme when Greg Berhalter comes in. I know, you know, he was his head coach for Columbus, but that's a different situation. I don't think Will Trapp is meant for the international game. He gave it his shot. Thank you very much. But I think Greg Berhalter is going to have to start looking and analyzing and say, Will, I'm sorry, I can't have you on the national team. Because right now that should have been McKennie, Green, and Tyler Adams. I understand they want to give Tyler the first 45 a break because of the playoffs he was going up against Columbus these last two times. But you know what, Cardick? I think we can see already that Tyler Adams is ahead of most of these midfielders that do play in MLS. And to me, that is the future, if not maybe the future captain of the U.S. Men's National Team, if and when, let's just say, for the hell of it, Christian Pulisic does or does not accept the captaincy armband.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea behind Will Trapp is he's a player that circulates the ball and he's able to keep the ball moving. And he helps organize the back four. But the back four are shambles. I think this is about as poor a match as I've seen from Matt Miazga in a U.S. shirt. Not going well for him at Nantes. So that's disappointing because we have a lot riding on him. John Brooks looks a step slow. It's as of his injuries. He hasn't been able to recover well from his injuries. He still reads the game pretty well. Still passes well from a deep lying position, but just a step slow. Left back, Viafania, I never want to see him again in the national team. I said that a year ago, right? After the Trinidad match, 13 months ago. But we saw him, Anthony Robinson, pulled a hamstring. Went back to Wigan right before the match. And then DeAndre Yedlin has been very poor of late. He hasn't been terrible for Newcastle, actually, but he's been poor for the U.S. Might be a reflection of the team around him. But so I think the thinking from Sarakin has been Trapp helps organize that back four sitting right in front of them. Now, Tyler Adams was a more dynamic player. We saw when Adams came into the match, was McKinney was allowed to go forward, was able to be sprung forward, and gave the U.S. some decent moments, some moments of quality for about 10 minutes in the second half. I thought the attacking play in the first half was Bobby Wood didn't get many touches. It's tough to judge him. He had a couple chances, though, that he whiffed on. I thought Julian Green had some nice moments. But the issue with Julian Green that we continue to see is we're not sure that he can fit any position. Okay, so Sarakin played him as a 10 yesterday. He's played him out wide. He's played him a little bit deeper. He's played him up top, right? And he's decent in all of these positions, but he's not the U.S.'s best option in any of those positions. That having been said, in the attacking end, in terms of creativity and some incisive passing, he's the only guy that gives that to you. I mean, Christian Pulisic historically has given it to us. If you look at qualifying for the World Cup, you know, starting with that game in Jacksonville in 2016 when he was just masterful against Trinidad and Tobago, a team we couldn't beat a year later when we needed to. But the game in here in Florida in Jacksonville, that run from that game until 2017 – game in also here in Florida against Panama in Orlando, he was just phenomenal in all those matches in terms of his creativity. But his creativity has dropped off. His playing time has dropped off at Borussia Dortmund. He didn't get into the game the other day. They're a classicer game. He's down on the bench, and Dortmund was chasing the game. They're down 2-1, and there were other attacking subs. Alcacer comes on. Finally throws Alcacer on. He throws Max Philippe on, but he does not throw Pulisic on. So he's falling deeper and deeper down the bench at Dortmund. He was playing more when he was 17 than he is when he's 20. So Julian Green's the only guy giving you that kind of level of creativity, but he's not the best U.S. player in any position. But I understand Sarakin is just thinking, like, I got to get him on the field. I got to get him on the pitch because he's the only guy who can deliver that cross or play that through ball, which we saw him play to Timmy Weah at one point. So I'm not sure where you play Green, but I guess you got to play him right now. Weah has had some decent moments. He's also was off at times, not consistent enough for me yesterday. And, I think it goes a lot better when you have Adams in the team. The question is about Will Trapp, because I think that's the guy you drop. I know people have said, well, why don't you drop Weah or Green? Now, Green, I think you eventually drop, but you keep him on the 23. He's probably maybe the first guy you bring off the bench if you're chasing a match, because, as I said, especially in stretch games, he can deliver a killer ball or score a goal like we saw against Belgium, obviously, 4 years ago now, more than 4 years ago now. But the guy you drop. The question, Daniel, and you watch Tyler Adams every week, can Adams circulate the ball and recycle possession playing in a number six role as well as Will Trapp? Now, I think he probably can. In fact, that's why Jesse Marsh thought it was okay to allow Dax McCarty to leave Red Bull and go to Chicago two seasons ago. But the general sense among the U.S. people camp is that Trapp is better in that role. I don't think he is. Now, and if you want someone in that role, maybe you bring Michael Bradley back. I don't know. But I think you need to look for a more dynamic player in that role. And maybe Trapp is a short-term solution, and you see the Adams there long-term. But, yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think you want to get Tyler Adams in this team. And you certainly, I think, need to think about the situation on the back line with Matt Miazga. Now, has performed poorly in a couple of games, but it's particularly this game. It's the worst game I've seen from him in the U.S. shirt. Brooks being a step slow, and then obviously the keeper situation has not been resolved. We'll see what we get from Ethan Horvath and Jonathan Klinsmann. Jonathan Klinsmann's a keeper I'm very excited about, obviously Jurgen Klinsmann's son. I think he has a great future. The problem is he hasn't gotten a first-team game yet at Hertha Berlin. So it's tough to throw a keeper in for the national team who's not playing at the club. But look, we don't have many options. And I think the upside for Klinsmann, in my opinion, is better than Horvath or Steffen. So I want to see if Sarakin might want to give him roll the dice and maybe play him in this Italy game, but probably just wants to get him the reps of training. Now, as far as Guzan is concerned, I'm not quite sure what to say because I still like Brad Guzan. I think his footwork is very good for an American keeper. I think his footwork is even better than Tim Howard's was. But he's 34. He will be almost 39 or 38 and a half because, remember, the World Cup is going to be in the winter in Qatar. Do you foresee him being in that team? I don't, but Daniel, the question is, will there be someone who emerges as a number one and a number two? I've just thrown out three names, Horvath, Steffen, Klinsmann. Now, you always have the possibility of a Bill Hamid coming back or someone of that age group, but it's probably going to be those three guys. Now, if one of them falls off, do you reach and bring Guzan back into the team as your third keeper, or do you just, you know, go with a Bill Hamid or someone like that who's just a serviceable American keeper? Maybe Fry from Seattle. Maybe that's the guy, or obviously Alex Bono. I think Toronto had a rough time of it, but he's still a young guy that maybe you look at long term. But I'm concerned about the keeper situation. I'm concerned about a lot of things, in other words.
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, there has to be some concern because we want to see some sort of progress right now. Okay, no World Cup for the first time since the 1986 World Cup. And, you know, we need to see who's going to step it up. We're going to need to see who wants their position that badly. Look, I think Zach Steffen and Jurgen Klinsmann's kid, Jonathan, will be in the running for at least number one, number two. I say Steffen number one and Jonathan Klinsmann number two. That, to me, that is, you know, what I believe to be number one, number two right there, Steffen and Klinsmann. If you still
right.
want to say, you know, Brad Guzan as a
right,
third
right, I think,
stringer,
I think
you know,
let
I mean,
let me just jump in for
I mean,
Daniel.
I mean, I don't
Daniel,
mind
I
seeing
think,
him as a vet.
Right. Daniel, let me jump in for a minute. I think it's got to be those two. I go with you on that. I want to see what Horvath gives us, but I think I just think the upside for Jonathan Klinsmann. A lot of people don't like him because of whose son he is. I don't like his dad as a manager, but I don't have anything personal against his father, and I think the kid could be a fantastic keeper, could be the next in the line of great American keepers. So I want to see him, and I want to see Steffen. We've seen enough from Steffen to know that he can hack it at the international level. I know two very soft goals for the Red Bulls the other day, but sorry to cut you off. I just want to say I agree with you. Those are the two guys.
Yeah, those are the two guys.
I don't know.
Well, let me say about Guzan, at least you need a veteran out there that's been through the wars. And I'm not saying I'm against Guzan being on the national team, you know, if he is a third string keeper, I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know, if you need him on an emergency basis, then that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I just don't see Guzan anymore as a starter. It's not so much the footwork I have a problem with the Guzan. It's more of the decision-making he has. And I'll still go back to the Copa America Centenario match against Argentina. You know, damn if you do, damn if you don't. You need to know who has the ball at their feet. And when he got chipped by Lionel Messi, as soon as Messi had the ball, and as soon as Guzan was at least maybe, what, 5-6 steps, maybe 7 steps away from his net, you knew he was dead in the water. You knew he was dead in the water,
yeah,
and you knew
no,
that he
I,
wasn't
not,
going to be able
I,
to come back.
Both Bob Bradley and I'm not sure Bruce Arena liked Guzan, but both Bob Bradley and Jurgen Klinsmann gave him probably far more chances than he deserved. Bradley especially. I mean, he would come in second half of friendlies all the time for Bradley. I mean, there was a horrible goal he gave up at Wembley that I saw for the U.S. Steven Gerrard scored, where he came off his line too late, recognized and it was a mistake to begin with at the back that led to this goal. I'm trying to remember it was in front of me at Wembley, but that was in 2008. But yeah, I tend to agree with you, and I think both Klinsmann and Bradley had some selection issues with him. I think they've fallen in love with what they've seen in training. That Messi goal is a clear example. Now, this having been said, Guzan has kept two clean sheets. No, sorry, not two clean sheets, but has gotten two draws at Azteca.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, just look, I'm not.
I mean, that's pretty good. But maybe it's not because of him. Maybe we just played well those nights and he didn't face many shots.
Yeah. Now, I agree with you there. Now, here's the thing that I wanted to talk to you about real quick, because apparently on Facebook, I don't know if you've heard of The 18. It's a soccer media news company that's all the way over in Boulder, Colorado. I want to just give them a shout-out because I just saw them do a little Facebook Live while doing FIFA, playing FIFA on their I don't know if it's an Xbox or their PS4 or whatever it was. But they were talking about where they think Christian Pulisic should be more as a wide or wing player in the midfield to bring up the ball. Maybe he doesn't do much in the middle. Here's the only reason I will agree and disagree with that idea. I believe if Michael Bradley comes into the national team from starting 2019, whoever's the national team manager, the head coach, whatever you want to say it, the only way to me that Christian Pulisic is going to be playing from the wing on the right is if Michael Bradley will be in the midfield, but as an attacking midfielder in the center part of the pitch. If he's central,
wow.
Michael Bradley is central, then I want to see Pulisic on the right wide as a right-winged midfielder. Other than if he's not back, Cardick, let me just finish my thought. If he's not back, Michael Bradley, if whoever's the head coach does not bring back Michael Bradley, then Pulisic should remain central. That's all I'm saying. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know what Berhalter's thought about that is, but clearly Dave Sarokin thought yesterday that that Pulisic should be coming off the right, much like the 18 believe. Because he played Julian Green as the number 10. I don't know if a lot of people – the U.S. formation was so messed up, and the shape was so bad, and the performance was so bad, I don't think a lot of people realized that Green was actually playing centrally, or was at least supposed to be playing centrally, and Pulisic was supposed to be playing coming off the right and cutting inside, and Weah on the left cutting inside. So I think Sarokin had the same idea you and the 18 have. So sorry to try and cut you off there earlier. I didn't mean to cut off your thoughts.
I know. Don't worry about it. I know. We're good friends. That's okay.
So I'm not even sure Berhalter, if Bradley comes back, yeah, that makes the solution easy. What we saw Sarokin do is he pushed Weston McKennie into that position after Green got subbed out. I think there's a general sense that Pulisic gets marked out of games when he's playing centrally. So you want him to be able to kind of find pockets of space and drift and find that space. But he's got to get games at Dortmund. And this is the curse of having guys. You know, there are a lot of people who say, hey, we want our guys at the highest level possible, biggest clubs. But they have to have some realization that we don't have the elite talent level players of guys that can break into the team at PSG or consistently hold down a starting spot at Borussia Dortmund. That's the reality. I mean, Christian Pulisic is not getting games at Dortmund. He's not going to get games. A lot of his earlier time, and he impressed, no question about it, he was very good. But a lot of his earlier time at Dortmund, he got to play because there are two consistently injury-prone players in that team, Mario Götze and Marco Reus. In fact, Reus has missed all the international tournaments for Germany because he always seems to get hurt. And he was the guy they really missed this past summer. Götze had a long illness even and was out for 6 months or so. So Pulisic had a pretty uninterrupted run in the team for a while. What we saw is last season he wasn't as good as the previous season. Getting more game time to play more regularly, his fitness levels dropped. Then he started picking up nagging injuries. Now this season he's fallen behind Jadon Sancho, the English phenom who came transfer from Man City. He's fallen behind Max Philippe. And Götze and Reus are both healthy, or they're both fit. So the other guys that he was competing for time were Andrea Sherla and Andrei Yarmolenko, the Ukrainian international. Both those guys have left and gone to the Premier League. So he's got to get games. And if he doesn't get games, I think you're going to see these kinds of bouts of him not being match sharp, which is what we saw yesterday. We saw some strange touches, strange decisions. He still has that dynamism, but the creativity is lacking, and I think the decision-making, the sharpness, even when he's on that breakaway, really puts himself in position to be one-on-one with Pickford. Even the thought process in when he takes that shot has been impacted by lack of match fitness and match sharpness. A year ago, he buried that. This year, he hesitates. He took one too many touches, and Pickford makes a pretty routine save. And then a minute later, Lingard has that wonder goal. So, I think Pulisic, and players go through this, right? He's 20. We anointed him at 17 as like the next, I mean, we anointed him as the American bestie at 17, or the American Ronaldo. A lot of pressure on him. We got to understand that he's at a big club, and you don't just walk into the Borussia Dortmund team, and if it's not going to work out there, he's going to have to move this summer. Same thing for Timmy
Weah.
Timmy Weah is going to have to go out on loan, get games elsewhere. Weston McKennie is consistently getting games at Schalke, so that's not a problem, except when he's injured. Tyler Adams is going to go to Leipzig, we hope, and hopefully he gets games there. I think he's going to fit in well there.
Listen. With Jesse Marsh at Leipzig, you better believe he's going to get. I'm not saying he's the head guy, but you know, look, Ragnarok.
Marsh has a lot of
Ragnick, I should
Ragnick,
say Ragnick. Ragnick, you know, you trust Jesse Marsh, and
yeah,
they're going to use Tyler Adams.
Yeah, so he's with Jesse and Ralph Ragnick. I want to remind people when England hired Sam Allardyce, the other coach they considered was Ralph Ragnick, even though he's German. So that tells you how good a coach he is. And then Allardyce obviously got into trouble, and Gareth Southgate has taken over and has, exceeded everyone's wildest dreams in England. I mean, they just look. It's unfortunate for England in this generation. France has got the players they have because England would be right. I mean, England is dying to win a World Cup. They're dying to win a Euro. They got France in their way, unfortunately, and Belgium in their way. But certainly one of the top three or four national teams in the world right now, England. But back to the Pulisic discussion. I think he is struggling for match sharpness, and because he's struggling for match sharpness, you cannot play him centrally right now. You can't play through him. Daniel, we have a lot of issues. We have guys not playing at big clubs. We have guys who are playing at smaller clubs who are not playing well. Bobby Wood is not playing that well for Hannover, although he's been playing better of late. We have a guy in Kellen Acosta who I don't think has played particularly well in MLS this season, either with Dallas or Colorado. A little better with Colorado, maybe. Matt Miazga is playing terribly at Nantes, from what I understand. I have not seen them play, but that's what I've been told. Brooks, I've seen with Wolfsburg, Wolfsburg a few times. I haven't been terribly impressed with his performances. Yedlin is hit or miss at Newcastle. But Yedlin seems to play better for Newcastle than he does for the national team. So that's another concern. So there's something going on there. He's not communicating well with his teammates. Villafania, I think, is absolute rubbish. I wouldn't call him in again. We have a left back problem, but maybe, you know, this is now the time to try to consider other options. I don't know if Jonathan Amon, you know, he can play left midfield. I don't know if he can play left back, but Anthony Robinson, obviously, is the left back of the future. He can stay fit. But so many questions coming out of this friendly. We got a match in Belgium on Tuesday against Italy. And hoping for a better result. But I don't care about the result. I'm more concerned about the process and what we see. That's why I'm so overreacted to this friendly. If people want to say I've overreacted, I'm so reacted to this friendly, Daniel. It's that the 3-0 doesn't bother me. Okay, we've been beaten 3-0 and 4-0 by a lot of countries lately. It was the performance. The level of the performance was horrible. The lack of interest, the lack of ideas, the lack of creativity, the poor shape, the poor decisions made on the ball. We couldn't even string two or three passes together in our own end. I mean, if England pressed high, we turned the ball over. And it's just unforgivable. I cannot imagine what would have happened in the World Cup if we had qualified performing like this. The other point I would make is that we are in a situation where we are now basically, unless Greg Berhalter wants to change things radically, basically reliant on the set of players you saw out there in this match. Okay? Go ahead. No, I was just going to say you could call
Michael
Bradley.
No, I'm just
going to
say,
back.
Look, I think Berhalter has himself a refurbishment job here. I think you're going to have to start weeding out players that is not he feels that can't do it anymore, and he's going to have to go with whoever is getting minutes in Europe, who's getting minutes and succeeding in MLS. And this is the big thing he needs to do. He's going to have to weed out the ones that he feels either A, they're too old and can't do it anymore. B, if you're not getting minutes, you're not going to be on the national team. C, I'm going to pick the best players I can. And D, he's going to have to tell some of his players that, who has done well for him in Columbus that can't do it on the international stage anymore. You're going to have to tell them, listen, and I still stress this. I'm sorry for Will Trapp, but still though, Will, I'm sorry. You're not the player that, is going to be ready for the national team. And if you, and I'll say this right now, what the Red Bulls did to the Columbus Crew in the second leg at Red Bull Arena, I think what both Sean Davis and Tyler Adams did to Federico Higuain, to Will Trapp, and to Justin Miram, that shows to me that Tyler Adams, now I don't know about Sean Davis, maybe he's not ready yet for it, or maybe he doesn't pick him, but there could be better players than Sean Davis, I understand. But I think it's going to be Tyler Adams that's definitely going to be in that position where he's going to be the box-to-box midfielder that you need so you can at least allow Michael Bradley to get free or Christian Pulisic to get free centrally to go and attack. They'll attack. Tyler can play defense. He can do run back defensively. He'll do run backs defensively. He's a very good box-to-box midfielder, and he can convert whenever he is ready to convert, and he can. And I'll talk about the center backs. You know what? If Brooks and Miazga are not going to do the job, then fine. Aaron Long, Tim Parker, they are the best center back tandem right now in MLS defensively. I don't know anyone else in MLS right now that can be better. Matt Beasler does a good job by himself, but I don't know about his center back partner with Sporting Kansas City.
I'll say this right now.
I think it's Tim Parker and Aaron Long, center backs for the national team. I apologize for tooting the Red Bull horn, but from what I've seen from those two, when they are, when they're switched on, they cannot be stopped when they are together.
Well, I think that's true. I think the Long and Parker pairing is intriguing to me. I think that they're very good. I do like the idea of having a ball-playing center half, which is what John Brooks is and what Matt Miazga is. But you have to have a ball winner in there, too. I think I think Aaron Long is a good shout. So we'll see on that. I mean, the range of passing that John Brooks has is better than anyone in our pool at center back. So I think he's still got to be in the mix, but obviously there have been some issues in terms of his ability to just kind of maintain his fitness levels. You mentioned midfield. I think Will Trapp has always looked good being playing in the same midfield as Justin Meerum. He didn't have him for half a season when he went to Orlando, that ill-fated move to Orlando. You could tell. I don't think Will Trapp was quite as good in that period. So we'll see. Will Trapp, I'm told, has a lot of leadership abilities that the other players don't have in this player pool when you have a young team. Greg Berhalter probably feels that way too. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I guess the big question is about the Berhalter years coming in front of us is how did U.S. soccer arrive at the conclusion that this was the right guy for the job when, as I said earlier, I can report that Jesse Marsh hasn't been interviewed. I know others have reported that that Juan Carlos Osorio wanted the job and wasn't interviewed. And then Taylor Twellman has reported that Peter Vermees was not interviewed. So, again, your top three candidates, I think those were your established top three candidates, were not interviewed. And then you have on top of that the issue of potentially Tata Martino, who would have been at the very top of that list were he interested, not even considered. So Greg Berhalter is going to be dogged, rightly or wrongly, by the fact that there is a large contingent of the U.S. fan base that believes he does not deserve this job, was not given the job based on a process of merit, was not hired based on a meritorious process, and that he, while he's done nicely with Columbus, there are other guys that are Americans that are fairly young that have done a better job in Major League Soccer. So this is something that the U.S. Soccer Federation and Greg Berhalter and the U.S. men's national team are going to have to deal with, because I don't think that there's anyone that I talk to who in the game that would tell me that they would pick Berhalter over all of the above, Marsh, Osorio, Vermees, maybe even you throw in a Caleb Porter into that mix, maybe even you throw in one or two other coaches into that mix, young American coaches into that mix. Tata Martino, I don't think there's anyone who would actually go with Berhalter in that situation. Now, to make it more complicated, it appears he was not there has not been a proper interview process for the job. So that's got a lot of people angry about it. And Daniel, I'm wondering your thoughts on this process. What are your thoughts about hearing that Juan Carlos Osorio was not contacted about the job when he was interested, that Peter Vermees has not been interviewed? I mean, what are your thoughts about these shocking revelations?
You know, let me just go back and say this. You know, when you're on Twitter and social media and you're seeing Mexican fans, national team fans, yelling for Juan Carlos Osorio to be fired in the middle of a World Cup because he didn't get the necessary result in the final group stage match. And, you know, when you're seeing that happening and they're all yelling for him to get fired, you know, fire Osorio now, I said, fine. You want him fired now? I'll take him right now as U.S. men's national team coach. I'll take him right now because I know what Osorio can do. We all seen what Osorio can do. The only issue, you know, to be honest, was that, you know, as always, you know, fans who are from Mexico are impatient that, you know, one wrong result and you're already in their doghouse. And it's for no reason.
About what they think, I could care less what they think.
No, I'm not concerned. No, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. No. That's what I'm saying, Cardiff.
No, no. At that point,
that's
I thought it was
saying.
Pretty obvious, and you did too. You, me,
yeah.
And a number of other important people thought it was pretty obvious. A number of other people connected in this sport thought it was very obvious that U.S. Soccer, Carlos Cordero, Dan Flynn, whoever, would be on the phone with Juan Carlos Osorio the second Mexico landed back in Mexico after they lost to Brazil. No phone call was made. No attempt to talk to him was made. And I can't understand this. And then to learn that Vermees hasn't gotten an interview, to learn that Marsh hasn't gotten an interview, I just don't understand what's going on here. I mean, do you have any explanation? Do you have a defense for the Federation?
Yes, I do have an explanation. And the explanation is this. U.S. Soccer does not want to be criticized. U.S. Soccer does not want a manager to go behind their backs and criticize the whole setup. They don't want to be criticized. They don't want a manager who's going to run the national team, and then when he gets asked a question about something, that he'll throw his opinions out there saying, well, this is what I think should change, and this is what I think should happen. They didn't want that. You know, the whole thing with Jurgen Klinsmann when he was managing the national team, he was already criticizing, you know, MLS, Commissioner Don Garber. We both enjoyed the back and forth of the tennis match to see who was going to land the ace and who was going to smash a volley. All you can say is that, you know, and Don Garber, you know, I mean, you needed Sunil Gulati to calm the waters, to put out the fires, to make sure that everybody is on the same page. And this is the issue we have right now that's silly, stupid, and dumb. If you're not going to hire the right person, if you're not going to do a proper vetting of hiring a head coach, and you know what? And let me just say this right now. I just want to say this right now. And this is the thing that bothers me sometimes because I would like to separate the politics and sports mixing in together. Unfortunately, it'll never happen. But I'm sick and tired of the political racism that gets yelled at from some people. They're saying, what's the reason why that Tata Martino did not get the national team job? What's the reason why Juan Carlos Osorio didn't get the national team job? Well, they didn't want, you know, they're going to throw their political racism crap all over the place, which is not true. Because if those two did not get a phone call, well, guess what? Jesse Marsh didn't get a phone call, and Peter Vermees didn't get a phone call. And any other manager that was probably should have been interviewed for this job that was white, solid in MLS or anywhere around the world.
An American.
They did not get. They did not get a phone call from U.S. Soccer.
Yeah, yeah. It's the U.S. national team. We sometimes forget that. So just because American managers are being mentioned, it's not racism. I mean, the American managers tend to be white or African American. We have a couple of Hispanic American managers, but the reality was that people had a short list of guys that they favored, and generally on that list were Juan Carlos Osorio and Jesse Marsh. Those were my two candidates. I wasn't as hot on Peter Vermees, but I certainly think with the number of trophies Vermees has won with Sporting Kansas City and the style of football they played, this is the other consideration. I have to mention this. There is a clear style of football and development philosophy of young players that is connected to Peter Vermees and to Jesse Marsh. There is not to Greg Berhalter. So I just don't understand it. I don't understand why you wouldn't at least sound out other candidates, why you wouldn't have some sort of longer-term vision for this thing. But look, I mean, they're going to do what they're going to do, and we're going to have to just deal with the consequences of it, good and bad.
Exactly. And let me just say this, Kardik. Tab Ramos, two consecutive under-20 World Cups, gotten out of the group stage and has been eliminated in the quarterfinals of the under-20 World Cups. Two consecutive under-20 World Cups, and they've been eliminated in the quarterfinals. One was the eventual World Cup champions in Serbia that went to a penalty kick shootout. Sadly, losing to Venezuela, who eventually got to the final but lost to England. So if Tab Ramos is doing something right with the under-20s, why can't he get the job for the senior team of the national team? Unless, A, they feel he's not good enough for the senior team, or, B, Maybe Todd Ramos doesn't want to be a senior national team head coach, and he'd rather just coach the kids. You know? Maybe he doesn't feel he's ready for that big move. And that's fine. You know? But, you know, I would put Tab Ramos into the, you know, into the discussion myself. But, you know, look what he's doing right now as we're talking about this. The CONCACAF Under-20 tournament is going on right now. And last I checked, I'm going to get a quick update right here. You know, the United States was leading Costa Rica 2-0. As of right now, as I'm looking at the website for CONCACAF, it's 3-0. 3-0 United States. We're in the 73rd minute, and I think if this result holds, maybe the United States does move forward, but then again, they got to play one more match because that would put them 3 points ahead, and that would be a point each between Costa Rica and Honduras. So I believe they need that second match in their final group stage level to get to, not just to get to the World Cup for the Under-20 World Cup next year, but at least to get to the final of the CONCACAF Under-20 tournament. But, you know, once again, you know, Tab Ramos has done a great job. I know CONCACAF opposition, it's not that strong until you get to the big boys. And, of course, I think Mexico is already going into the World Cup. The United States is now, you know, 15, 16 minutes away from winning their group stage match in the second level. But once again, you know, I just feel like, okay, you're upset that Tata Martino didn't get interviewed? So am I. Are you upset that Juan Carlos Osorio didn't get interviewed? You know what? So am I, because I said right off the bat to all these Mexico fans, hey, listen, you want Osorio fired now in the middle of the World Cup? Fine. I'll take him for as a U.S. men's national team head coach. I'll take him. He knows MLS. You know, he's lived in the United States for a long time. He's aware of what goes on in the USA. He knows what to do and, you know, what players to get ready to go. You know, he's ready for that. You know, you don't want him anymore for El Tri? Fine. Stars and Stripes. Give him the jacket now. Let him manage the U.S. men's national team, and let's go ahead and let's get ready for, you know, some great World Cup qualifying, you know, once the structure's done and once we get to that semifinal round for the draw when it's over in Qatar. You know, it goes to the fact where I will say this right now, Kardik. If Greg's brother Jay, who works for U.S. Soccer, is the second most powerful person below Carlos Cordero or below the members of the board of U.S. Soccer, if he is the second most popular, not popular, the second most powerful person within U.S. Soccer, and he has a say to go off and tell everybody, hire my brother Greg, because I believe he will get us back on track. If that is the case, and they decided not to do an interview process for anyone who's eligible to become the next U.S. men's national team head coach, damned if the language barrier is a problem, I do not care. This is the problem we're having, is that if you're not going to do things by the book, and you know what, if you make this process fair and transparent, then the issues will not be popped up. Now, there might be some problems if the person that's eventually picked does go and take over. There will be some grumblings. That's fine. But the point is that don't be scared about what the fans think. You have to go through a process. You go and study the tape. You do this, you do that. And if you have an issue with something, then for goodness sakes, get the issue out of the way. And let me say this about Ernie Stewart, which I think he's going to do an admirable job. He'll do a great job with this brand new position. But what I don't want to see is Ernie Stewart's hands tied, not by himself, but by U.S. Soccer, by Carlos Cordero, or by the board of U.S. Soccer, because if you've hired him to be in charge of making this national team better and to bring in the proper head coach to run this cycle, do not turn him into your Muppet. Let Ernie Stewart do his job.
Yeah, I don't think Ernie Stewart is necessarily the actual job description for the general manager position is not what I think we thought it was. I think he has essentially the autonomy of a low level staffer. so he can do interviews, he can ferret out candidates, he can do correspondence, he can keep lists, but I don't think he can actually make decisions. I think Dan Flynn and Jay Berhalter are making decisions on this.
And I think that's
and
wrong.
If you don't think Jay Berhalter, yeah, and if you don't think Jay Berhalter is involved in the decision-making process just because it's been reported he would recuse himself, I think you're very naive as to how much influence Jay Berhalter has around every little thing U.S. soccer does. So I think it's going to be I think it's going to be very, very difficult for the U.S. Federation to have the sort of credibility that's necessary when things go bad again. And they will go bad again with the set of players we have currently and with just the whole development structure. To have the sort of goodwill they might want from the fan base and from certain quarters in the media, I would even say most of the media at this point, to fall back on it. I think that they've got a major credibility problem, Daniel, and it's only getting worse with the way this so-called search has been handled over the last 13 months. I mean, there are national teams that have cycled through three or four managers since the U.S. began its, quote, search for one. And the U.S. hasn't done any interviews. I mean, this is the thing. I think what we saw when Sunil Gulati took an awful long time to hire Bob Bradley is that there were conversations with the likes of Jurgen Klinsmann and Jose Pekerman and Fabio Capello. He shot for the moon and he didn't make it. But there was an idea of what he wanted from Sunil Gulati. This time there's – I don't even know. I can't even fathom what the thought process was. Unless the
See,
idea
once
was
again,
entire
right. And once again, you know, Kardik, and let me just say this right now, 4-0 United States against Costa Rica in the under-20 championships of CONCACAF right now. So it looks like they will be able to have a comfortable position to get to the under-20 championship final. But, you know, the point is this. Has U.S. soccer learned from the mistakes that were made towards the tail end of 2017? Did U.S. soccer learn from their mistakes in trying to get this national team program back up and running? Because here is the situation right now. What are we looking for this national team to do? What are we trying to do to get this national team back up to speed? Are we trying to just say, you know what, we're just here for the hell of it? Or are we seriously looking to win a World Cup? Okay? I understand we're in the Confederation where it's not so great. Does it need more powerhouses? Absolutely. We know that Mexico, United States, will always be the top-notch nations in this Confederation. We know that Costa Rica is getting up there. Panama is going to get up there right now. They're doing very well. Honduras is probably taking a couple of steps back. El Salvador is taking a couple of steps back. Guatemala is not what they used to be back in the day. Canada needs some form of a spark, and hopefully their Canadian Premier League will have that positiveness going forward to make the North Zone strong. At the moment, Jamaica is probably the strongest within the Caribbean. Trinidad and Tobago is a hit or miss. Maybe Suriname could be that factor in the future. I don't know. It's a shame we don't have Nathan Carr anymore to, you know, report on what's going on in the Caribbean. You know, as of right now, we're having issues, you know, with, you know, competition within our confederation. And maybe this CONCACAF Nations League can become something special. We'll see what happens down the road. Yeah, but once again, right. Our players need top-notch minutes. And if it's not an MLS, you know, they're going to need it somewhere else. And it has to be at least somewhere in Europe or in South America, depending on where they're going to play. Even in Mexico, you know, if some of these players want to give Mexico a chance to play in the Liga MX, go for it. You know, they'll take you now. But the truth of the matter is this, is that what is going on internally? Because, like we've already said this, if Jay Berhalter is the second most powerful man in U.S. soccer, then what's the point of having elections and having Carlos Cordero running the federation? Just should have just moved it to Jay Berhalter. Let him be the face of U.S. soccer.
I think there's a reason this is going on. I have to say that I think there's been a very there's a lot of hostility some of Cordero's ideas in terms of reform. So the staff, the permanent staff, Verhalter and Flynn have assumed that power.
And that's a shame, because we cannot continue to go through a broke. We cannot have this broken record continue on in another cycle, because you know what's going to happen, Kardik, is that where will these players grow and what will they do on the international stage? Because I'm telling you right now, if they, I mean, you have to say it right now. And I'm not saying this to put an ire into U.S. soccer. I don't want to, but I have to, because they need to understand this. Mexico continues to churn youth after youth after youth to improve their national team. That will be the future after Chicharito is gone, Guardado is gone, you know, since Borghetti has been gone, Cuauhtemoc Blanco is gone, you know, where is the next generation? Well, we already know about the next generation. We know how strong and solid they are. Do we have another generation here? Yes, we do. But the problem is this. Are they going to be talented enough and quality enough to make the move that we want them to make? You know, when was the last time we've gotten deep into the World Cup? 2002. We had some solid veterans. We've had some great young players, DeMarcus Beasley, Landon Donovan, mixed up with Claudio Reyna, Brian McBride, Eddie Lewis, Kobe Jones, and we knew they were on their last legs, some of those players, for the national team. Landon Donovan, DeMarcus Beasley, you know, then Jozy Altidore, Tim Howard after both Casey Keller and Brad Friedel. So where is the next generation coming in? Is it here? I believe so. But is their quality strong enough where they're going to make a push to not just qualify for the World Cup, but to actually go deep since the quarterfinals of 2002? That is the next big question. And if they're not going to make that push, then what's the point?
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know what the point is anymore if we're not going to be ambitious, other than maybe financial considerations, which I think drives a lot of this federation's thinking. It's all about money.
I hope not. Because I mean, you know, I'm not saying money is the root of all evil, but the point is that, yes, there needs to be money to fund programs. There needs to be money to fund these programs, whatever U.S. Soccer is trying to do to find the next Landon Donovan. Okay, to find the next Christian Pulisic now. I'm not trying to put any pressure on the kid, but sadly, he's been thrown into the spotlight, and now, you know, he's a part of this. Now you're looking for the next Christian Pulisic. Now you're looking for the next Tyler Adams. You're looking for the next Zach Steffen. Who is going to be that player? Where will those players come from? And that's the big question mark. You know, it's not just finding it in the typical backyards of the typical places you're going to find. You're going to have to find and give an opportunity to someone that can probably move the ball around somewhere in, you know, downtown Orlando, somewhere in Harlem in New York City, somewhere in some neighborhood not good enough in Los Angeles that deserves an opportunity, or not such a good neighborhood in Dallas or in Houston or in Chicago. Because if you don't find that gutty, gritty player that's going to do the opposition dirty, we're going to spiral backwards. We're going to regress. And so far the regression has happened. Do we still have talented players? I believe so. But is the quality good enough? That's the number one issue. And, Kardik, your final thoughts, please.
Yeah, we have a long way to go. I don't know that we've made that much progress in the last year. And there's a lot of frustrating things at the federation level. So a lot of concerns out there.
Very much so. And we don't want to say it, but, I mean, we got to be truthful about it. Because, you know, we cannot shove, you know, roses and sunshine up the backsides of every U.S. soccer fan. Every U.S. soccer fan has to understand there are problems. And we are not stupid, and the U.S. soccer fans of today are not stupid. They're savvy enough. They're aware of the situations, and they want to see change. And if we're not going to see change from U.S. soccer internally, then someone's going to have to come in radically and make those changes if possible. Ladies and gentlemen, this will do it for our review show. Unfortunately, the United States, they fall to England 3-0. And, you know, we didn't get a chance to say this. Congratulations to Wayne Rooney. Got an award from England, from the FA.
Yeah.
And glad to see him get rewarded for his time with the national team, his final match. And hopefully Clint Dempsey will get a testimonial one day as well. But for Carter Kushner of World Soccer Talk, this is Daniel Feuerstein here, the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. Join us after the friendly against Italy, which will be in a neutral site in Belgium. Thank you very much for listening to us tonight. And as always, please enjoy your football. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye for now.